When we dance, the journey itself is the point. When we play music, you will simply become completely absorbed in sound. And therefore you will find yourself living in an eternal now in which there is no past and there is no future and there is no thing called difference between yourself and the world of nature outside you.
Ideas demand action, philosophy thrives through practice, and talk only flourishes when it inspires meaningful deeds. Welcome to the Talk Doesn't Cook Rice podcast with myself, John Staskowski, and Danny Massaro, where we explore thought-provoking concepts and provide practical insights to enrich modern life. We hope you enjoy this episode.
This is something. This is nothing. This is a solid. This is space. Between yourself and the world of nature outside you.
Right, Danny, nostalgia. Sure, it's a word that everyone recognises, so even when it popped up on your podcast app, you'll have thought, oh, I wonder what they're going to talk about this for. It's a word we all use, but it's maybe an interesting area that we've never thought about in too much depth. And we certainly thought there's a bit of meat here to be had, isn't there? There's some interesting insights into human nature and things that might come out of it. So nostalgia as a word was actually first introduced by a Swiss medical student, a guy called J. Hoffer, back in 1698, so a hell of a long time ago. And at the time, he was making a literal translation from the German word of Heimweh. So he's going from German into Greek, and both words literally mean a painful yearning for home or country. So at the time, what he was doing was, he was basically bringing a medical dimension to homesickness. So they were treating homesickness for people like soldiers, servants who had been sent abroad and things like that in Switzerland at the time, were getting this sense of homesickness. And Hoffer was basically prescribing that as a disease, or diagnosing that as a disease, which, you know, was obviously a negative thing. But from there, it went on a little bit. So when you get into the American Civil War, and nostalgia at that point was very much seen as something you should be ashamed of. So it was seen as like unmanly, idle, you're weak-willed. And there was this military doctor called Theodore Calhoun, and his treatment for it is like, right, you've just got to scare it out of them. You've got to shame them out of nostalgia. So things like public ridicule and bullying were the answer to feeling this sense of nostalgia at the time. And it's obviously moved on a little bit from then. So that's a few hundred years ago now. It's moved on to, so the common definition we would probably give it now that's in the literature is, nostalgia is an emotion defined as a sentimental longing or wistful affection for the past. So it's moving more towards time rather than place. So rather than being homesick, it's like a time sickness where we wist after things that have happened in the past. And for most people, that tends to present as like a sense of happiness, but it can also be tinted with like a longing or a loss or a desire to sort of go back in time. So it's a bit of a bittersweet memory in many ways. And when you think of nostalgia in that sense, it's something that has appeared. It's been a major theme really in sort of myths and poetry and literature, going all the way back to like the Bible and Homer's Odyssey and literature like that, where they've given voice to this human phenomenon. And one of the papers I was reading, it was talked about that there can't be a person who's alive who hasn't experienced nostalgia at some point. So it's really, really ingrained in us as humans. Got a bit more popular in the 1960s in like books and magazines and nostalgia. Like I said, it moved away from that homesickness aspect to much more, because people were just more mobile now. They were moving around the world, they were traveling more. It wasn't so much home being a place anymore. It was this aspect of home being a time, and especially when you're childhood and things like that. So that's a little bit of an intro to it as a topic. One thing that I don't know, it'd be interesting to get into, Danny, I want to get your point of view initially, but is it more prominent and powerful now than ever before in the current day? Certainly an interesting aspect, I think. We've got loads of stuff to get into around it as a topic, so you just dive in now with your initial perspective on this as a theme, really.
Well, I think it's everywhere in nowadays anyway, isn't it? In marketing, you know, in terms of retro this, retro that, all the old bands have come back, haven't they? There's probably always been products around, you know, originality. So like original Coke and, you know, original like things around, for example, say hippie movement and 80s is a big thing, isn't it? Or, you know, like lots of 80s movies and lots of 80s songs and lots of 80s TV shows and things like that. You see a lot of comebacks in things like, there was a Sex in the City, Laura's watching the new one of them. It's like 25 years on. I don't know if she actually likes it, but for half an hour when she sat there, she goes into some sort of trance. Watching it, doing a string of racket or something, watching it, or clicking, you know, and it's on in the background, and she sort of knows it's pretty pathetic, but obviously she's got a real connection. So I think, yeah, if people are feeling more than ever that they're looking for meaning or looking for something that's a good feeling, then yeah, there's people definitely access that, and the marketing people know how to sell that, don't they?
Top Gun, that was us, wasn't it? Top Gun Maverick,
yeah.
Maybe longer now. That was like full on pure 80s nostalgia, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Watched Top Gun as a kid, that film was just like amazing. It genuinely was. We went to the cinema to watch it, me and my wife, and actually sat there, I was like just buzzing. Like the feel of it, everything was there, wasn't it? The music, the vibe of it was just, and it did, it took you right back, and you were like, this, you came out of there just buzzing. I remember texting you going, just bit of see that. Absolutely amazing.
Well, you know, I saw something about that the other day, about the new, why that Top Gun film was a pretty successful last year. It was not so much, yeah, obviously the music and, you know, and it reminding you and things, but the theme of it was about, it was just a simple, silly theme, isn't it? You know, like American man hero simplifies everything, goes out, conquers his demons, can solve any problem he wants, gets some team spirit together, and it's as simple as that, and we win. And that simple narrative of, you know, yeah, you know, it's not, whereas a lot of films have become more these days, they've become more like about angst and self-reflection, and are we living in a just world? And everything's a lot deeper than the simplicity of, you know, or the romanticism of just, you know, man conquers alien and that's the end of that. You know, like, aren't men brilliant, you know? And, you know, I know that perhaps come back a little bit with Wonder Woman, you know, and people, oh, that's a simple narrative again that was popular, or the superhero movies. But then, you know, nowadays there's so many more themes coming in, isn't there, you know, about more world themes and messages. And back in the day, it was a little, films were a lot more simple, they were just making a simple point.
Even TV, like another one that we've loved in recent times, Stranger Things, that's just pure 80s, isn't it? And it's, yeah, like kids, a bit like the Goonies back in the day, getting in adventures, getting in like danger, but they're gonna sort it out and be there. That was on Cobra Kai,
yeah,
bit of a Karate Kid sort of spin-off. And I watched that, it wasn't as good, it was good initially, but it just lost its, I think initially you just got that initial Mr. Miyagi buzz and like the Karate Kid, yeah, thing, and then it just wore off a little bit. But there's loads of that stuff at the minute. I remember reading when we first talked about this podcast ages ago, I remember reading an article about this TV director saying how enthusiastic people are now for TV shows that are set in the 80s and 90s. BBC were commissioning loads because they were so popular, and it's sort of like life just seemed a little bit easier, a bit of a simpler time, and people like watching shows like that because it gives them that nostalgic sense of, yeah, that's what it was like then. It was better in many ways.
Well, I think there's a sense with nostalgia that one of the things is the sense of a time that we now, and what was in that time we've lost. So it's a little bit like that used to be that way, but we don't have it like that anymore. We can't access it. It's almost like it's frozen in time. You know, if you think, like, for some of my friends, they always long to go back to Ibiza. You know, they're like, I want to go back to that, almost that time. It wasn't just the place. It was like the holidays we had and the vibe and the, but it's kind of like, oh, that time's gone. It'll never be like that again. And it's true. You know, you not only have you moved on and it is a different time, but that isn't to say that some young kids having their time, you know, in 30 years they might be nostalgic for what they've just gone through today. So I think it's very biased. I think nostalgia can get very sort of like biased and skewed by your own not only unreliable memories as well, because you tend to cherry pick all the best aspects of how that was. And I think, you know, therefore that's kind of good, because it is your, it's just a private little thing that you get a good feeling for. But to generalize it across, when you start generalizing, I think then it's hard because you're almost compined for it too much. Yeah. You can then start thinking, oh, what we don't have now, and these aren't great days. The days we're in now aren't great because back then it was so this and that. And there was a great line in The Sopranos, wasn't there, with Tony Soprano, when they were chatting about the old days in the mafia or whatever and so on.
And Tom, remember when we all rented that house down the shore with the bed bugs?
Summer of 78, Carlo, Silvio, Frankie Napoli.
Place up the beach. Yeah. Sonny Spence from the Bronx rented it. Uh-huh. That's where that hippie kid mysteriously drowned during that party.
Hey, Tom. You okay?
Yeah. You sure tea. You're being kind of quiet.
Well, that's because, remember when it's the lowest form of conversation.
Move on. Yeah, it stuck with me. You know, remember when is the lowest form of conversation. And I was like, yeah, I get that, because, you know, there's nothing worse, is there? Every time you meet someone, they're just going on about the past and the great times and this and that. And that's okay, like, for the odd little thing. But sometimes it's, I think nostalgia's, it can be shared and you can have a little chat and how that were funny, a few stories. But I think nostalgia is useful more as a very sort of private, personal thing that just gives you a flash of a feeling. Yeah, it was funny. I was out with the dog this morning and all the conkers were on the floor, you know, out of the trees, and just the horse chestnut tree or whatever. And they were all over the floor. And I get an immediate feeling, private little feeling of the time of year, and maybe flashback to when I used to go with my dad, you know, trying to get them. It's like a 2 second feeling, and it just springs you that way. I think that's where nostalgia's quite nice. And the other one is smells, isn't it? You know, when you smell certain things, something that Proust even talked about 200 years ago, you know, about the smell of biscuits and how it instantly transports you to, like, your grandma's kitchen or something, or, you know, school days. So smell is another one that's, you know, that goes straight into your brain. It's decoded by the amygdala, by the brain, straight off. It's the only sense that does it instantly. So, you know, when you have a smell, obviously that can be a bad thing as well, and could cause you to be homesick, or it can be a bad memory. But essentially, yeah, you can get nostalgic smells, like an old aftershave or something like that, or a perfume. Takes you back.
That's the key part with it. If we think psychologically, it's a massive stimulus response in it. So it's an emotion that's triggered by something, some kind of stimulus in the environment,
yeah,
that then kicks in. So it's things like, and I was reading a few different studies around, you know, like different aspects, but like things like music, films like we've talked about, scents like you're mentioning there, that can all be just like an instant trigger that you get it. It's like bang, and it's just there instantly. And that can come and go quite quick, or you can probably start to ruminate on it and think more on it. But it's also triggered by adverse psychological stimuli. So if you're feeling lonely, that might be a trigger for, like, thinking of a time when you're talking about mates been in Ibiza. So maybe you're going to start thinking, oh yeah, when we were all together and we were a group and all that sort of thing. Even things like weather was shown to be quite a big stimuli of nostalgia. So certain, like, types of weather and temperatures can trigger nostalgia for a different time. Around that as well, there was an interesting one I found about heat. So when you remember, when you have nostalgia for memories that involve warm and sort of warm weather, they tend to be appraised much more positively. And it has then a literal, like, there was a study I was reading where they triggered people to have, like, nostalgic memories, and they literally got warmer thinking about this warm memory in the past. So it's quite embodied, like thinking of when we talked about Merleau Ponty last time, a lot of this is very embodied. When you mentioned memory, actually, a little bit ago, that's a fascinating aspect of it. So apparently, from a neuroscience perspective and all that stuff, the way we encode memories during adolescence and younger adulthood is, like, way more and way stronger in those parts of life. So that's in the mix when you're having those memories to those times when you're younger. It's because we're just better at encoding memory in those periods of life. And there's an interesting thing I was reading about, because I was thinking about kids now going back to school.
Yeah.
And, like, the classic thing is, it's, oh, like, did you have a good summer holiday?
Yeah.
And apparently, like, studies show when you ask someone nearer to the event, so if you ask kids now, first week back, you know, did you have a good summer holiday? The positives and negatives will be pretty much similar. So they'll have as many good things that they remember as well as bad things.
Okay.
But over time, the further you get away from the event, the negative emotions get fewer. So that list of like negative, and they tend to just remember the positive things about that.
Yeah.
That summer. So there's like an interesting angle there of how when we, just how memory works and how we forget certain things, but not others.
Yeah.
How we encode them. Because I think there is a thing as well around, well, like anything to do with learning, isn't it? The more you recollect something, the more you're going to encode it. And it's just like a stronger memory. So
I think that would work on, I'd be interesting, because if you have an overall decision, you know, like an overall conclusion that, yeah, I like school, or I used to like school holidays, this is how I found it. I have periods of my life and it's like I've got this, so I think, oh, that period, and I go, oh, I like that. And I am very, I can only remember the good bits. Whereas in some periods where I've kind of gone, like, no, I'm not too sure about that. I don't get that feeling when I think of it. Like when I was at university, I don't get that feeling, but I get it for when I was at college, and I get it for a bit of school days. And so I know that, like, I'll dwell more on the negative feelings of what happened at university and not promote the positives. But at the school, I'll up the positives and probably forget some of the negatives. I do when I recollect myself, you know, like being at college and living by myself. Actually, there were loads of ups and downs when I think back, but, you know, properly in detail, there had to be. But all I remember is like, oh no, I just got it boxed off, good times. And then I sort of biasly force myself, well, don't force it, it just comes, oh, I remember that were good. And I like talking about it. And I think that just gets reinforced over the years into my self story.
Yeah.
You know, whereas I do see some people, they'll go, oh no, I hated my school. And I'm like, well, you can't. And they've decided that that's not nostalgia, because that's not a good time. I think that's, you know, where they remember the bad stuff. And even on a small level, that's how you get that with squash tournaments and squash matches. When I help people, they'll say, oh, that was a brilliant tournament, that one. But they forget, because they won it once or twice. And in their brain, they have a history with that event. But they forget the 8 other times they went there and it was terrible. But it's like, overall, I've decided it was good. And then everything just starts to be like quite cool, isn't it? You know, same with pop groups or film stars. You don't remember all the bad bits. You just, oh, they were good at that, good at that, good at that. And I think you just keep going over it and over it. And I like that. I think I read a researcher who said it's quite nice to have a bank of nostalgic gold, you know, like little moments that you can always rely on that make you feel good. You think, well, no matter what happens, that was good. That was a good moment. That was a good moment in my life. They were good times, you know, and it makes you feel nice that you've lived a, you know, like a meaningfully good and enjoyable existence. But just to have a bank of those things, you know, and then you can play around with them, maybe tap back into it a little bit, or try and go and resurrect it in some small way. And maybe there's lessons in it. Maybe the time or the place, it was your like slot, your groove. Maybe those things have something to teach you, and maybe you can get back to it in some small doses. It's a really personal thing, isn't it? Nostalgia.
From a memory perspective, though, you think for us to even stick anything in your head, so to go into long-term memory, there basically has to be some kind of an emotional experience attached to it. So like moments of high emotion are more memorable, aren't they, for that? So it helps with that process. But yeah. It was a guy called Karim Nader. I was reading some work he'd done around nostalgia and memory and things. And he was making the point that a lot of the evidence now shows that whenever you recall a memory, you alter it at the same time.
Yes.
So every single time you recall it and sort of relive it in your head, you'll also alter it at the same time. And he was sort of saying it's maybe not even possible to recall something without altering it.
Yeah.
So the more, like you're saying, like you've got your bank of like golden sort of thing, every time you get it back, you're changing it in some way. So there must be a point where, you know, 30, 40 years later, we're remembering stuff that is nowhere near how it actually happened, how it went down in the moment. But we've just created this goal. Memory's always fascinated me that way, how poor it is, how rubbish we are at remembering stuff.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
That's the cornerstone of a lot of therapy, isn't it? You know, you even repress memories and things like that. You can actually, you're making memories of memories of memories.
Yeah.
Memories, you know, and it goes on, and it's like, well, in that case, we can re-edit them. So if you can go back in time on a timeline, and you can mentally, you know, think about it and go back there and take, you know, one of the processes we used to do in NLP was you go back in time to that time and place as best as you could currently reconstruct it, a memory, and take an observer position on what happened. Try and take the self position, like what it was like for you to go through it. and also try and take the other position. What was the other person going through at the time? So actually, say you were pissed off at your parents, or you were, you know, or something like that. You can go back and go, actually, from their perspective, they were only doing what they could do. As an observer perspective on that, it was, you know, nothing really happened. It was just like, it wasn't as dramatic as you've made it out. But from your perspective, I can see why you've, you know, not got over it, or you think it's the best time in the world's history and it's, you just want to go back there, actually. So you get this new information, maybe change what you felt around it, then you walk back through your timeline and all the future sort of times where it was significant, that memory, where it played a significant moment that held you back, or you can kind of reinterpret that as well. And you almost change your story, you almost change the way you remember it, and you give it more colour or different angles and different perspectives. And if just it takes you into a new place, so it frees you from the sort of stuck one version of the events that you have, and that you get a bit of movement around it. So that's the cornerstones of a lot of therapy, isn't it? Whether you do it NLP or talking, or some people take drugs and things to try and go back. And so, yeah, that proves that memory does that. And I think nostalgia, like I say, I don't think you want to ruin. You know, if your nostalgia is healthy and you get a little nice feeling from listening to an old band, or you go and watch a tribute band or something, or you go and you have a little moment and are watching all, you sit down with some food that you know, an old way you like to make your cup of tea or bacon butty or your beans on toast, or your you know, a certain way popcorn, whatever it is you like, and you watch an old movie and you have a moment and it's nice. No, there's no need to change that, is there? But if you're becoming really like fed up with modern life and everything's dull and nothing, everything's lost, there's a lost time that I can never get back to. And these are often the good days, but if you're not careful, you're just like, these can't be the good days, because they were the good days back there. And I think that's a dead important point that you've got to remember, that these are also the good days.
Yeah.
Although, because you see, and then the only days you've got in actuality, yeah, we do think through time, but in actuality, those days are gone. But these days are important, and they're pleasurable. And they're hard, and they're all, you know, but they're what you've got. And I just think, I do think you've got to be careful. And I also, what I found was interesting, I think the book that we read about it was, utopian people are people who think that these aren't the good days either. The future is what's the good days. The future's the good days. So not these days. These days are kind of not, these aren't the great days. These can't be. So if you're not careful, if you become utopian, you're pining for something that's not here, which isn't a no good thing, although it might create a bit of energy towards it, you know, but you don't want to get stuck there. And equally, if you're too into the past, like what they'd say about people who are avant-garde, and oh, you know, when things were simple, you know, when we just hunted fish and, you know, had a log fire and blah, 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 and everything was a simple life. That was how we need to get back to that. None of this modern media and technology, oh, just get back to the simple. Like, yeah, there could be some information in that that's useful. But again, you're longing for a time that's gone. And this is, you're here. So, yeah, for me, being a pragmatist, yeah, use nostalgia, you know, if it gives you a little kick up the arse, to make now good.
Well, that's a good point to bring in the different types of nostalgia, because it's one of those areas where you just start like, yeah, it's interesting. And then you dig a little deeper and there's quite a body of literature and there's people researching it and getting into it now. And you realise that it's not just nostalgia, there's different types of nostalgia. So the typical one is, or the classic view really, is that what you might call personal nostalgia. And that's just where it's like conventional, past focused, and you're just thinking back to your memories, whether they're happiness or sadness, but it's very personal to you. So that's personal nostalgia. But you also get historical nostalgia, which is also called animoia. I'm probably pronouncing that totally incorrect. But that's where you're missing a time period in the past that you never actually lived through. So people have this historical nostalgia, a bit like you were saying, where it's like, oh yeah, I bet the 50s were amazing. Like, I wish I lived in the 50s and that sort of thing. And it's really associated with that dissatisfaction of the current time you're in. You know, you're really cynical and pessimistic about, oh, it's shit these days. It's like, it's rubbish this. You never used to do that. In the 50s, we'd have done this. And that one, there's a really nice film I watched called, I don't think you've watched it yet, have you? Midnight in Paris, Woody Allen film, which really got into that historical nostalgia a little bit, and I'll try and clip in a clip from the film, but there's a really nice scene in that where Owen Wilson, the guy in the film, is a writer and he's in Paris, and without wanting to plot spoil too much, he ends up traveling back to the 1920s in Paris and that's his, like, that's the time he just thought, I bet it was amazing there, because you've got like Hemingway and people like that knocking around, like other writers, and he meets them and he's knocking around with like Picasso and people like this in the 1920s, and then he goes back to normal day, like once the next morning comes around. But he keeps going back and he ends up meeting this woman in the 1920s who he then starts a relationship with, but she wants to go back in time to the 1890s. So even though she lives in the era that he feels is like the golden age, and she lives in it, and she's like, nah, the 1890s, that was the time. So they end up going back to the 1890s.
What are you talking about?
We should stay here. It's the start of La Belle Époque. It's the greatest, most beautiful era Paris has ever known.
Yeah, but what about the 20s and the Charleston and the Fitzgeralds and the Hemingways? I mean, I love those guys.
Well, it's the present. It's dull.
Dull? It's not my present. I'm from 2010.
What do you mean?
I dropped in on you the same way we're dropping in on the 1890s.
You did?
I was trying to escape my present the same way you're trying to escape yours, to a golden age.
Surely you don't think the 20s are a golden age?
Well, yeah, to me they are.
But I'm from the 20s and I'm telling you the golden age is La Belle Époque.
I mean, and look at these guys. I mean, to them, their golden age was the Renaissance. You know, they'd trade Belle Époque to be painting alongside Titian and Michelangelo. And those guys probably imagine life was a lot better when Kublai Khan was around. I'm having an insight now. It's a minor one, but it explains the anxiety, my dream that I had.
And then when they're in the 1890s, everyone there is talking about, I think it's the Renaissance. It's like, yeah, that would have been the best time to be around in the Renaissance. So everyone going back is just having this same sense of like historical nostalgia. Even though they never lived through that time, it doesn't matter what age they're in, that's what they wanted. So they were two quite nice times of, or types of nostalgia. Another interesting split, which I must admit got a little bit confusing for me, but then I thought, yeah, that actually does make sense. There's a difference between anticipated and anticipatory nostalgia, which there's quite a body of work been built around now. I think Christine Baccio was the researcher's name.
Yeah.
And that basically says that, so in anticipatory nostalgia, that's where you start missing things that you haven't yet lost. So you're still living through them in the moment. You haven't actually lost them yet, but you're already starting to miss them, even though they're happening now. So I said to you the other day when we were texting, saying about, oh, there might be, I don't know, say like Leo's lying on your chest.
Yeah.
And you just like, and you might start thinking, oh, you know, there's going to come a time where he won't do that anymore. So you'll start missing it in the moment where he's actually lying on your chest. Just enjoying that moment. Really? So that's this anticipatory nostalgia. And it, like I say, very much present moment, very much missing something you've still got. And she, Baccio, this researcher, they ended up developing this survey of anticipatory nostalgia, like a tool. And they found that people with a greater inclination to think about the future also tended to experience more of this anticipatory nostalgia. And people who have this anticipatory nostalgia, they tend to struggle in the present moment, or they tend to struggle to enjoy the present moment, and they're constantly sort of distancing themselves from experiencing, just being in the moment. And it's sort of like, so it's like they'll feel less hurt when it does eventually end. She was positing that this is part of the reason, but they've definitely got more of a tendency towards like sadness and worry and those sorts of emotions. So like I said, it's a bit like premature nostalgia.
Mm.
Instead of just like watching Leo play on the swings or like running around with Woody and enjoying it, you're kind of sad as you're watching him and going, oh, this is like, he won't be doing this forever.
Mm.
This will end soon. And yeah, it's that sort of a thing. So that's anticipatory nostalgia. Anticipated nostalgia, that's where you've got this foresight that one day you're going to miss this experience. It's almost like you're expecting that in the future you will have nostalgia for this moment that you're in now. It's just essentially more future focused, whereas the first one, it's like, it's more in the moment. It's like, oh yeah, I know I'm going to miss this in another 10 years. I'll probably look back on this and really love this moment. So you're just anticipating the nostalgia that's going to come.
Yeah.
That second one, so that anticipated nostalgia, there's another researcher called Yiva Bon Chung and colleagues. As she suggested, a bit like you did, she was like, you've got to sort of see this anticipated nostalgia as like a positive force and kind of think, no, I'm going to get stuff from my memory box. I need to keep piling stuff up. So they've got them in my memory bank in the future. So it's like, I'm going to look forward to having more positive memories, more meaningful experiences to look back on, rather than worrying about it in the moment and thinking, oh, it's not going to last forever, this. And
some people are more in time and some people are more through time, how they conscious, you know, some people are like, some people have filters, whether they like things to be the same, but some people like more difference, you know, in the world. They like variety. Some people just like repetition and sameness. And there's loads of those sort of opposites. There's hundreds of them, actually, and what, you know, and that people can have. And you can go, oh yeah, I'm definitely on that scale. Some people like sameness, but they like a bit of difference. So they like, they'll watch the same TV show for soap for 30 years, but they like slightly different plot lines, even though it's the same, really. Or they'll watch the same sport for 50 years. It's the same season after season, but there's just a few different outcomes. It's not like they're going from this sport to that sport to this sport, you know. So people mainly like sameness with difference. Hence, there's about 300 versions of a Kit Kat, right? So they won't veer too far away from it, but they'll keep tweaking it. But some people, you know, in terms of time, are very in time, some sort of more like in the moment, and some people more through time. So however you're using your past and your future, I suppose people are comfortable with, some people are more comfortable thinking about the future and planning for it and using it as a positive. So if you're thinking sometimes, oh, this is the last time I'm going to, you know, be with our friends, or this is getting towards the last, that can actually help you appreciate it and wake up.
Yeah.
No, you don't want to necessarily wait till something, you know, like you take it for granted. So a certain dose of anticipatory nostalgia or whatever.
No, that's exactly what she said. So that's anticipated, and that's definitely more associated with positive side effects. So being in the moment and going, oh, I reckon I'm going to miss it. I know in the future I'm going to look back on this and love this. And she was like, no, that's a good thing. Savor that moment, because the nostalgia is in the future. Whereas the anticipatory one, you start experiencing nostalgia in the moment. So you're now losing the moment because you've now been nostalgic about it, even though it hasn't even ended yet.
Yeah. And that's where you start. That can be anxiety, you know, because you're thinking about what you're going to lose.
Yeah.
Other than just actually what you're going to gain. Yeah. I'd say it's as simple as that.
See it as, I'm gaining an amazing memory to look back on in future.
And then you've got to make more of it. So that can, I've seen people with that. They do that so much of people I've helped a bit sometimes. They have anti-climaxes, or they're on holiday and they can't enjoy it because it's not good enough for the thing that they anticipated it to be on a nostalgic level. It's kind of got to be, this is the most money I've ever spent on a holiday. This has got to be all holidays I've ever had. Why is this holiday that's costed me 10 grand not as good as the little camping trip I had when I was 10? Like, what's wrong with me? Come on. And that's where it can, you've tried to create a lasting moment, a memory. And you know, that's full of all those Chevy Chase films, wasn't it? It's about, you know, the creating a great Christmas and we're going to have the best holiday, and it never works out because it's not spontaneous, and it's not. I think one of the bits that I'd like to bring in, I suppose, is what Simone de Beauvoir said about it. And this bit really rings true for me, that she said that when you're a child and you're young and you're sort of innocent, and particularly up to the age of 10, 11, 12 and so on, the world is so simple because all your job is to get up. And she called it just be a little scamp. You know, you're just a kid, be a kid, you get up, you wake up, and, you know, your parents are God, they know everything, and you just follow the rules, and you basically, that's it. So it's simple and you're innocent. But as soon as, like, you start thinking, you get to 14, 15, 16, then that's good because you know, you're thinking of more things, but you're still like a youngster. It's still exciting. There's still time to come and so on. But you've not got full responsibility, and you're not accountable. And you can always say, well, I'm young, what am I supposed to do? And you get away with that even into your 20s, don't you? You know, you can be doss about and mess around, and it'll always be, well, you're only 25, really, you know, if someone everyone's older and they're talking, you kind of get away with it. Especially when you hit like 30, you're supposed to have everything, your shit together, aren't you? You're supposed to be moved on. And the excuse of, oh, you're just a kid, is gone. And there's more weight and there's more, wow, am I going to buy a house? Am I going to save money? What am I going to be? So it's understandable that she said that you would always pine and be nostalgic for a time back when you were as a child, because even though you didn't know it at the time and you felt, you probably felt like a stressed teenager or something, what you didn't have was a huge burden of being an adult and having to grow up. So you set off and your old potential, and it's so vague and it's so I can be anything in a way, and it's so like no one's really holding me to account. And then you've got to like narrow down, haven't you, as you get older and funnel in. So nostalgia can, no wonder that you think about, without clocking it, you think about like summer holidays, you think when you did go on camping trips when you were younger, you didn't really have any, like, you didn't really have any existential pressure on you know, to be a certain thing. You could get away with things. So watching your movies, listening to songs, listening to lyrics of songs when you're 16, 17, you know, it's kind of a time that's, it's a waking up time, and it's quite a nice balanced time. You're older, you've got choices, you can do things, but you've not got ultimate expectation on you and pressure yet. You've still got some freedom to just be a kid. So that, you know, that's what a lot of the marketing people remember, don't they? That they say, get an any advert, if your target audience, put a song in from when they were 17 or 16, and it will be a hit advert, because they'll immediately get good associated feelings with that song, you know, and then probably buy the product or think, well, that can't be a bad product because they're in a good mood. So I think that was really interesting, that when you're younger, you're always going to think back without analysing it too much and have a sense of that it was simpler than when we're now older, and that's where you might sometimes feel more cynical because you know a lot more. You're a lot more worldly. The politicians look a lot more slimy. The world looks more cynical, more fragile. You know, and also the other thing is your time's running out, isn't it? Which we talked about in the Becker episode. Your time's running out to maybe be the things, the potential you thought you could be. And it might be just as simply nice to think, oh, back then I had so much time in front of me to be all the things I thought I could be. That in itself was a nice feeling. And, you know, and as you get older, perhaps that's one of the reasons you do pine backwards for things like that.
I think the book you mentioned, it's called On Nostalgia by a guy called David Berry. We both read that. It's quite a short little book, isn't it?
Yeah.
And he had some... I want to mention about the marketing just now, but just before that, you mentioned there about the Beauvoir and stuff. In that book, he mentions there was like Sumerian tablets, like stone tablets found sort of 5,000 years ago. So almost the first examples of writing that we've got. And even they were complaining about what life used to be like, or complaining now about what life's and like how it used to be better. And he has a section in there talking about like everyone says, or a lot of people when they do surveys and things will say that life is worse now in their country than it was 50 years ago. So anyone born in the 30s and 40s thought the 50s was the best. Anyone born in the 60s and 70s loved the 80s. All that sort of thing through time. And there's a psychologist in Erwin, I think he's called Claire Routledge, and he talks about boredom being a bit of a primer or a stimulus for that. So as a kid, you're probably less bored, aren't you? You've just got more to do. The world's just more. Everything's new. Everything's exciting. Everything's like, just like, wow, look at all this potential. And he talks about boredom just tapping into that nostalgia where you get this bit of existential angst and so you may be feeling a bit of lack of a purpose and you're losing a bit of meaning, and you cast your time back to where you just weren't feeling that. And it tends to be when you were a kid and life was exciting and possibilities and all that sort of thing. But yeah, it seems to be that that's quite just a human thing that everyone through time's experienced. The other thing that I think that Claire Routledge mentioned is if ever you feel like your identity has been attacked, nostalgia can be a good way to sort of consolidate who you think you are and what you're about and what you stand for and things. So
yeah, I get that, because it can be like a bit of a rock to hold on to.
Yeah,
I say all this and this, but I'm from this time and I'm this, and these were the best times, so no matter how much you bring me down, I'm from the best time.
Yeah,
you know, and I'll always will be, and you'll never get that. I think there's a naivety, and we've talked about that on our course, I'm in the membership course a bit. I was pointed out earlier that you sometimes being naive is actually a good place to be when you know a lot and you've played a lot of games and you've done a lot, you know, a lot of battle scars, and you've and so on, rather than it necessarily, you know, it's like Nietzsche's lion, isn't it? He advises you try and get back to the child spirit, which, you know, in a way is naivety, and not searching and pretending you know all the answers to all the politics, all the, you know, all the things going on, and all. Sometimes when you're older, there's a lot of pressure on you to have answers and to know stuff. And I think I've watched people who play around with nostalgia quite well, and they're quite healthy. They're happy to be naive and a bit like, I don't tune into that as much now. And I think you've got to know, I've said this, you know, you've got to know the level and what makes you tick. And I think you've got to also know what phase of life you're in and try and act to that phase. I think, yeah, it's nice to have memories and the times and pull on things, but if you're in a phase of your life like post-retirement or something, or you've got a new family, or you've got enough money to potentially now quit your job and chill out, I think you've got to adapt to that phase as best as you can and treat it like as new, you know, new time. This is a new good time. This is, although they were good phases and they had their moments and they had the down moments and the really good moments. And I like remembering those things. It's nice to have memories. But this phase I'm in now is equally fantastic. And that can help you be that like buoyant, naive, you know, like it's a new adventure right now. And that, you know, why can't you have that nearly in every 5 years or every decade or every phase you go into? So I think that's a good balance, because I think that also makes you, like, instead of just pining for a perfect, lost, forgotten past where things were just perfect, you can also think, well, my future phases are also going to be in and of themselves potentially as good as those ones were.
It is interesting as a kid though, isn't it? Or how, at least as a teenager, you often can't wait to be older. You just want to be older, so you've got more money, like you can just got more freedom, all those sorts of things. But then when you get there, you start being nostalgic for when you were the kid.
Yeah.
And it's like, where does that line cross, where you go from the future looks amazing to then you cross that line and it's like, oh no, the past was the best.
Yeah.
But you didn't appreciate it in the moment. So that's always interesting.
Yeah, that's kind of what I'm saying. It's trying not to do that.
Yeah.
Saying that, you cannot deny that when you live a life, you collect baggage, don't you? You know, there's not many people that don't collect, you know, wounds along the way.
Yeah.
So as much as you collect great things, you lose people. People get ill, people pass, you know, you might have been attacked. You've got things that have gone on. You do live in a different world, new fears, you know, you are aware of things. So it is tricky to ever totally be like a blank slate all the time. But that doesn't mean that, you know, I suppose if you have grief, you have lost people, it's nice to have memories and things, isn't it? But most people say, when, you know, if they are going to move on and die or whatever, and they die in comments, they generally say, live your life.
Yeah.
Don't live, move on, meet someone, don't worry about me kind of thing. Live your life and live it to the full, because you only get one, despite the wounds, despite the scars, or, you know, don't let them, I know they did that to you, those people, but don't let them rob you of your future. You know, these wits of wisdom and words, you know, it is a little bit similar to what we're saying, isn't it? It's about not being too stuck in the past. It's about moving on. It's about being hopeful, having faith. It's about this time can be as good as that time. And don't get stuck in the past, and don't long for a perfect future that never comes. But that doesn't mean you can never use your past and future thoughts to energize you and you know, like, give you a little boost along the way.
I think in terms of how other people use it on us as well. So that's maybe a nice, before we get towards like making some practical takeaways in a way. So there is in that Dave Berry book, there's a bit of a question running through it almost, where he's like, is modern culture, in a way, anti-nostalgic? Because everything's about, you know, when you're in a capitalist, consumer-driven society, you have to keep moving forward and buying and consuming. And so he's like, everything's the next thing, isn't it? Whether it's the next album, the next game, the next fashion, everything's like moving you forward. So in some ways, he makes the point, culture is anti-nostalgic. But then in other ways, that then results in people feeling a bit more alienated. They're sort of struggling to find meaning often. They're struggling for just a sense of self and who they are and things, which then makes you more nostalgic. And that's where then, especially politics, but also marketing jumps in. So politics, much of it now, nostalgia is brilliant for it, isn't it? Because what you're trying to do is just overwhelm people's I suppose, rational thought and just really get them to have like big knee-jerk emotions. And nostalgia is perfect for that. So when you see people like, well, all politicians really, they paint this really overly simplistic, rosy picture of the past on us. It's like, right, make America great again. And then you see some people, well, when was it great? Like, at what point are we talking about here? But it doesn't really matter. It's just like, no, get your yearning for the past and like things were amazing and I'll make them amazing again. Even though you never lived through them or know what that was like. So that can be something where I think people use it on us to tap into us emotionally. But definitely marketing.
America great again, isn't it? That's
like marketing, and again, that unlimited consumption. You've got to keep people consuming, so you've got to keep marketing to them. So it's perfect for that, isn't it? Creating an impulse that you want to buy something that's going to fill a gap or solve a problem.
Yeah.
Berry in that book, he says, tapping into nostalgia doesn't require creating a desire, only promising to fill the lack that already exists.
Yeah. I like that.
So if you think back to the century of the self and Edward Bernays and those things we've talked about in previous episodes, it's that, isn't it? Freud, those inner hidden desires. He's like, you don't even need to, just tap into the lack that they've already got. I did a session recently on Schopenhauer, didn't I, with our members, and that was a big part of him, this desire cycle we're on, where you want something because you feel like you're lacking it, you get it, and then before you know it, you're bored again, and it just kicks in forevermore, this cycle. So consumerism is a perfect breeding ground for nostalgia and tapping into it as a tool. And one of the good examples I quite liked in the book, he talks about freezers, and I think it might have been in the 1950s, and how they were doing a bit of market research and things like that, and they worked out that people weren't really bothered about sort of the efficiency and how convenient it was, and you know, they were promoting the technical specs of these freezers that they were trying to sling to people. But really, they worked out that people, when they saw a freezer, it reminded them of the last time they were safe and secure, and seeing a freezer full of food, again, it's a flashback to childhood of like, yeah, that's when I was safe and food. I just had to open the fridge or the freezer and food was there. I didn't have to earn money to go and buy it myself and all that stuff. So the marketers, again, they're tapping into these deep-rooted things, and that's what a lot of ads do. So you mentioned, I think, did you mention Christmas earlier?
Yeah.
I think you did. Like the John Lewis ads now, isn't it? Like, they love it. Like, bit of emotional music, footage of kids going downstairs on Christmas morning. And it's like, bang, it's just got you.
Yeah.
Straight away. Then that song goes massive.
Christmas is the ultimate in nostalgia. I mean, even within myself, that is my strongest nostalgia, Christmas, totally. I can think of it any moment and I just go,
boom. There's loads of studies that show that if you've got nostalgia in an advert, whether the product is your thing or not, it makes the advert more memorable. So it might be an advert for something you've got no interest in for whatever reason, but you'll still remember that advert because it taps into nostalgia. So again, for marketers, it's perfect. One of the favourite ones they give are examples, you know, like Quaker porridge oat.
Yes.
Everyone sort of knows that, the front of the box, don't they, with the Quaker guy.
Yeah.
But the company itself has got nothing to do with the Quakers. They just knew that, yeah, people associate Quakers with sort of honest dealing. So they put I think his name is William Penn, who is a bit of a philosopher and one of the original Quakers, on the front of the box. It's still on there now, isn't it? The people like the blue and red, yellow box.
Well, the big one is food as well. Like, you'll see jams, don't you, in old wrapping.
Old school, like, wrap chocolates and stuff, yeah.
They do it in like ye oldie. They say that a lot, ye oldie fudge, or this,
yeah.
You know, like, you go to any craft thing and it's all about like retro. You go to a castle and it's like, get an original this, and everybody, that's all nostalgic selling, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, I can have a piece of that feeling again. And even then, when you go and taste that fudge, oh, it's just like it used to taste, isn't it? All those lines, you know.
So it's a little, yeah, it's a little bit like,
brilliant.
It's not hammering that and saying that's a bad thing. I suppose for me, it's a little bit, and this is leading us into practical takeaways, like we said. It's maybe just being aware. Are you aware that you've been manipulated a little bit? Like, people are trying to push your buttons and try to get you to feel nostalgic sometimes, but it's not for your best interest. It's their best interest sometimes. So that was certainly something for me. Other practical takeaways, and I'm sure you've got some as well. So yeah, like, watch out for marketing, watch out for politicians. I think there's definitely a thing where it can be a negative or a positive. So it is okay to think about the past, isn't it? It's good. It can be a source of energy and like motivation and all those things. So it's never like, don't think about things in the past. But I think, and I said to you before we started recording, I think there is an aspect intuitively, just in your own bodily senses, if you find yourself being nostalgic way more than often, that can maybe be a bit of a signal, I think, where it's like you need to make a move, you need to do something, you need to proactively get out of the situation you're in, because your body's almost telling you before your mind's rationalized it that something's not happy. So if you're thinking about friends and past holidays, like past nights out and stuff like that, that could be a sign that you need to get out and like spend some time with your mates. You've isolated yourself. You're... And a little bit about when we talked about the anticipated and anticipatory nostalgia, like you were saying, don't get stuck being nostalgic in the moment. You're just losing all interest in what you're actually doing because you're worried about it not being there, which is just self-defeating. So we did do that episode, didn't we, about living in the moment and living in the present. There's probably links into there of enjoy the moment, don't think about too much about what's to come or what's gone already. It's like live it, because these could be golden moments that you will have nostalgia for in the future. Just keeping an eye on it, I think it's quite interesting to keep an eye on it. What makes you most nostalgic? What was it about those moments? Because there's probably stuff you could tap into and use now for the future. Like you said, you move into a new phase of life. It's like, all right, well, what am I going to be nostalgic about in 10 years' time that I'm doing now? Do more of it. Like bank more of those memories.
Yeah, I think the last thing for me then is there's a simplicity. Because you get such a good feeling of good nostalgia, there's a simplicity to it. It's just a place. You can't break it down too much, you know, but it might be a place, it might be a sound that just makes you feel good. Very, very simple terms. It's just something that makes you get a good feeling linked with reminiscing. And if you can feel that a little bit more, maybe that will give you some clues to how simple like life can actually be. And that might stop you panicking too much about, you know, having to get so many other experiences and have so much stuff. And, you know, it might remind you that actually the gold in life is like in the very small, simple things that sometimes you don't notice.
Yeah.
And it could be good to just, you know, go for that walk, go to that place, appreciate the little bits that are around you instead of overcomplicating everything.
There we go. Right, I'm going to go and have some Quaker oats and ye olde chocolate.
When we dance, the journey itself is the point. When we play music, you will simply become completely absorbed in sound. And therefore you will find yourself living in an eternal now in which there is no past and there is no future and there is no thing called difference between yourself and the world of nature outside you. This is red, this is green, this is something, this is nothing, this is solid, this is space. Between yourself and the world of nature outside you.